Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956 episode 2.13. Last time, the scheming and sneakiness reached a fever pitch. The three concerned powers of France, Britain, and Israel settled their differences and ironed out the cracks in their unlikely alliance with only days to spare before D-Day. It was an alliance based on mutual interest rather than friendship. Certainly in the Anglo-French case, such a drastic and conspiratorial action as the one they had signed up for would never have been countenanced in previous years had the circumstances not been so desperate. Falling confidence in their governments, growing security concerns, a desire for revenge against Nasser, a pressing need to hold the Suez Canal, and perhaps a wish to turn back the clock to when Egyptian rulers did what they were told, all proved effective motivational tools for Prime Minister Anthony Eden, Premier Guy Mollet, and President David Ben-Gurion. The fix was officially in by the time everyone returned home on the 24th of October, 1956. There seemed little indication that, thousands of miles away, Budapest would be alight with revolution against the Soviet Union. There was only Egypt. There was only Suez that occupied the considerations of the Anglo-French-Israeli alliance set down in the Sèvres Protocol. In this episode, with the plotting complete, we detail the final moments of peace and the final acts of deliberate sabotage, manipulation, and deceit which followed. It is a fascinating story for sure, and represents the culmination of several threads in our story, so I hope you enjoy it. I will now take you to late October 1956. Monsieur le Minister, you are going to attack us, it seems? The Egyptian ambassador to France asked. Pierre Maillard froze. He was charged with directing the African Levant section of the Quai d'Orsay, but he had been told that everything was under the strictest of secrecy. Maillard didn't know what to say, but after a few tense seconds, the Egyptian ambassador let out a deep belly laugh, saying, "No, no, I am teasing you. You know, two diplomats from a communist country have come to tell me that you are going to attack us at the same time as Israel. But this is ridiculous. If this was true, you would not be able to stop the repatriation of your citizens. These stories of invasion are completely false, and I have underlined this in the dispatches that I have sent to Cairo." Perhaps the Egyptian ambassador had been sounding his French counterpart out. Perhaps he had attempted to warn him in this backhanded manner, or perhaps he was signalling the fact that Egypt had friends, and these friends kept her well informed. How the hell had the Egyptian ambassador to France found out about the plan? Pierre Maillard wondered. The date was the 27th of October, only 48 hours from D-Day. Maillard reported the exchange to his superior, Christian Pinault, who told him not to worry and to play it cool. It was far too late in the day for the Egyptians to protect themselves now. If Egypt was shorn of its protections, then the Anglo-French political systems were kicked in high gear in their efforts to create plausible deniability at home and abroad. In his meeting with his cabinet on the morning of the 25th of October, Anthony Eden made no mention of the Sèvres Protocol, which tied Britain to action against Egypt alongside Israel and France in this sneaky scheme. Instead, Eden revealed only portions of what was rumoured to be going down in the Middle East, and he noted, "It now appeared that the Israelis were, after all, advancing their military preparations with a view to making an attack on Egypt. The French government were strongly of the view that intervention would be justified in order to limit the hostilities, and that for this purpose it would be right to launch the military operation against Egypt which had already been mounted. Indeed, it was possible that if we declined to join them, they would take military action alone or in conjunction with Israel." No mention of the Sèvres Protocol left Eden's lips while among his cabinet, and yet he still worked here to present Britain's best course of action as one which followed that protocol's tenets. Britain would intervene alongside France to secure the Middle East from the consequences of the Egyptian-Israeli conflict, Eden said, without mentioning that the latter conflict was all part of the plan. Eden was even able to create the same ultimatum strategy which the protocol laid down, as the cabinet decided, "In the event of an Israeli attack on Egypt, the government should join with the French government in calling on the two belligerents to stop hostilities and to withdraw their forces to a distance of 10 miles from the canal, and should warn both belligerents that, if either or both of them failed to undertake within 12 hours to comply with these requirements, British and French forces would intervene in order to ensure compliance. Harkening back to the intense debate over legalities which had been ongoing for several weeks, the cabinet minutes for the 25th of October demonstrated that, in the official opinion held by Eden's peers, there was now justifiable legal grounds for intervention. The minutes read, "Our action would be defensible in international law, for we should be intervening to prevent interference with the free flow of traffic through the canal, which was an international necessity. We should be entitled to use whatever force was necessary for that purpose, and the degree of force used could match the extent of the opposition encountered. The United States had acted in conformity with these principles on many occasions in the last 100 years. Throughout October, Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice had tied himself in knots in his mission to successfully discern a legal case for intervention in Egypt. That Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice had convinced himself of the futility of this mission by the end of it did not dissuade another figure, the Lord Chancellor, a committed interventionist that we've met before, called Lord Kilmure. And Lord Kilmure was not dissuaded against thinking out loud, so to speak, and of creating his own legal logic for the intervention. On the 21st of October, in a lengthy memorandum which Kilmure did not send to the legal officers, but which he elected to leave with Anthony Eden's private secretary instead, Kilmure demonstrated his talent for contradicting himself and making empty noise. His arguments are something to behold, and deserve some mention here. As the Lord Chancellor, Kilmure was an important member of Eden's cabinet, and almost certainly knew and approved of the Sèvres Protocol, and the negotiations which began in its name the day after he left this memo on Eden's desk. Taken in the context of the Suez Crisis, Kilmure's memo captured the mood of the interventionists and how thin their case was in the moments before the Sèvres Protocol was signed. It helps us to appreciate where Eden's head was at and why he believed that collusion was the better option. Having surely read or been informed of Kilmure's memo by the 22nd of October, when the collusion truly began, Eden likely came to the conclusion that without the help of the Franco-Israelis, Britain would never find the justification that was necessary for intervention in Egypt. In his desperation, did Lord Kilmure cite the work of Oxford international law professor C.H. Waldock, without realising that Waldock argued against the very point Kilmure was attempting to make. Waldock's 1952 article, which the Lord Chancellor was so fond of, was entitled "The Regulation of the Use of Force by Individual States in International Law." Grasping at straws, Lord Kilmure believed that Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, which touched on a state's right to self-defence, did not go far enough. It was here that he chose to cite Professor Waldock's article, clearly without appreciating that, in this extract, Waldock had been speaking hypothetically rather than theoretically. The extract read, "Logic would suggest that if very valuable foreign property was in danger of irreparable injury through the breakdown of law and order, entry by the foreign state for the sole purpose of securing the safety of that property might be excusable, e.g. in the case of a hydroelectric power station serving two states, or a water barrage to control flooding in a river." Lord Kilmure must have been pleased with himself. Not only had he found a legal argument which argued that intervention in the name of self-defence of certain property was acceptable, he also managed to find property referred to as a waterway, a close and deliberate parallel to the Suez Canal. Lord Kilmure concluded in this report with the following breathtaking exercise in self-assurance. "If we could show, as I think we could, that the blocking of the canal for a considerable period would probably cause damage to a number of nations, for which it would be difficult to see adequate compensation being given, then our intervention could also be justified by the danger to the canal. It might not, however, be necessary to consider the question of property for this reason. If we intervened to prevent violence and the risk of death to British citizens, the situation might well arise when Colonel Nasser would say, 'I shall resist with all the power I have any landing of British and French troops.' If he said that, then the amount of force permitted to us automatically is extended. The force should be proportionate to the object of the exercise, namely, protecting our people. But if the Egyptians say that they will resist with all their land and air forces against any attempt at protection, then we are entitled to use such force as will defeat the forces which the Egyptians threaten to employ." it is possible that the emptiness of this memo from Lord Kilmure and the lack of any substance within it persuaded Eden that collusion with France and Israel, undertaken the next day, as in the day after he got this memo, was the only option. Certainly, by the 21st of October, when the memo arrived on Eden's desk, much had already been prepared between the three conspirators. Yet there was also much to be done, and we have seen in previous episodes that the British came close to torpedoing the negotiations and could well have backed down now if they had wished. Historians seek to explain Eden's motivations for agreeing to collude with the Franco-Israeli camp in a number of ways. Eden's health often comes up in the debate over why he did what he did, as he had suffered a fever in early October, which rendered him incapacitated and hospitalised while Selwyn Lloyd was away in the United Nations during the first week of October. Thanks to injuries to his bile duct, Eden was in constant and increasing pain, and since July 1955 had been on a steadily rising cocktail of amphetamines and relaxants for the pain. Robert Carr was a close friend of Anthony Eden's and had been his parliamentary private secretary during this period. Regarding the connection between Eden's decision-making and his deteriorating health, Robert Carr noted, "I find it difficult to accept the judgment that Anthony's health did not have a decisive influence, at least on the conduct of his policy. I agree that he might well have pursued the same basic policy had he been well, but I find it very hard to believe that he would have made such obvious miscalculations in its execution both in the political and military spheres. In the end, it must come down to a judgment call. Do we believe that Eden was motivated to act out of character and to accept the supremely risky plan which was proposed to him by the French in his Chequers residence on the 14th of October because his ill health and medication clouded his mind, or because he was blinded by hatred of President Nasser and utterly determined to avenge himself upon that hated figure, whatever the costs? Certainly in his memoirs, Anthony Nutting saw fit to ask, in reference to the decision to collude with the French and Israelis, how and why was this mortal decision arrived at, and how and why did the man, whose whole political career had been founded on his genius for negotiation, act so wildly out of character? In my view, if you're interested in my view, it is very difficult to weigh in either way on the question of Eden's health. While he certainly seemed to be a sick man, he was also careful of making deliberate and calculated decisions, even while those calculations turned out to be incorrect. For example, Eden was aware enough of the weight of governmental opinion to only authorise Anthony Nutting to talk to two senior Foreign Office diplomats, and Eden ensured that this specifically excluded the legal adviser, Sir Gerald Fitzmaurice. Eden knew that the Attorney General and the Foreign Office legal adviser would say that what he proposed to do could not be justified in international law. So instead he relied on advice from the Lord Chancellor, Lord Kilmure, who we've met before, even while Lord Kilmure was not constitutionally the legal adviser to the Cabinet or the Prime Minister. But Eden pushed Nutting to talk to Kilmure because he knew that Kilmure believed that intervention could be legally justified. To me, these don't seem like the schemes of a man who had lost his faculties. Eden was deliberately hiding details from some colleagues and excluding others from the entire process. Ignoring protocol and structures which he would have followed a year before could be used to show that Eden was too unwell to think straight, or could be used to demonstrate that the Prime Minister was so singularly focused on the end goal that he no longer cared for established government protocol any longer. He would bypass the Foreign Office altogether for large sections of this period, between the 14th to 25th of October, and he surrounded himself with people who held views similar to his own on the Egyptian situation. The observations of Eden's peers, who remembered the events of the crisis later on, can also be seen as evidence of Eden's reliance and warping by his medication and illness, or at the same time, of his blindness and anxiety incurred by the weight of his responsibilities and his hatred of Nasser. Alec Douglas Home, a friend of Eden's and an interventionist, recalled in 1987 that the Prime Minister was not undoubtedly well. I don't think it probably clouded his judgment. That will be for historians to tell later on. Another senior figure in the Defence Ministry added that Eden was very jumpy, very nervy, very wrought, before going on to describe Eden as having developed what one might call a pathological feeling about Nasser. and as being in a state of what you might call exaltation. He wasn't really 100% in control of himself. Extraordinary, strange things happened. While the jury is still out as to the extent of Eden's fitness for rule, there isn't enough conclusive evidence, in my view, to prove that the Prime Minister was significantly affected by his medication or illness during the crisis. Since all symptoms and suspect behaviour can be put down to pressure and nerves in the heat of the moment, as well as a passionate feeling of hatred towards Nasser, we're likely to go around in circles if we examine the debate much longer. In his examination of Eden's convoluted but also immensely complex diplomacy before the Suez Crisis, the historian W. Scott Lucas was of the opinion that unless we examine the crisis in the context of the system of alliances which Britain had built up in the Middle East, we cannot fully appreciate the factors which compelled Eden to act. Lucas concluded on the debate of Eden's health that the Anglo-French-Israeli move was not the product of a sick, irrational Prime Minister. It was a considered decision taken by a group of ministers after a full and lengthy consideration of the political, military and economic situation. It is worth considering an additional motive, not just for intervention in Egypt, but for leaving the Americans in the dark. Eden would note in his memoirs in 1960 that we have many times led Europe in the fight for freedom. It would be an ignoble end to our long history if we accepted to perish by degrees. Eden added that the seizure of the Suez Canal had left Europe without a choice in the matter. Force would have to be used against Egypt independently of the United States. This would, in the process, challenge the existing global order and American predominance within, or, lest Britain would be forced to accept, a master and vassal relationship. We have seen before how both the British and French subscribed to the idea that only with their empires or commonwealths could they keep pace with the other world powers of the day. Suez and President Nasser represented distinct and serious challenges to this potential. But what of the idea that Britain and France could somehow speak for Western Europe, that it could act in the name of Italy, West Germany, or the Low Countries in asserting European importance independently of the United States? While we may view the Cold War as a bipolar situation, with the West versus the East, or capitalism versus communism, or something to that effect, the reality is, in the mid-1950s, that the situation was a great deal more complex. In the first place, the British had come around gradually to the fact that the Americans were not interested in developing NATO any further. Where London desired a political alliance, with the relations between each member of NATO being normalised, Washington rejected this in fear of a British attempt, or an attempt by any other state within NATO, to use the alliance to compel American intervention in any of the bloody colonial wars which continued to be waged by the Europeans. NATO was to be a defensive alliance, an exercise in collective security, mostly directed against the Soviets, and nothing more. To the French, dissatisfaction loomed from the shattering experience of defeat and retreat from imperialism in Asia, but also from issues closer to home. Neither the Brussels Pact nor the Western European Union, which emerged, appeared particularly strong, and great divergences in opinion existed over where West Germany should stand in all of this. Should West Germany be permitted to field its own army, to possess nuclear weapons, or to have an equal say in how any European Union might be developed? In Paris, the answer to all of these questions remained a determined none. The order of the day, in spite of a great reduction in French hostility towards the Germans since 1945, was to increase French influence and prevent the Germans from entering the equation on an equal footing to the French. The French desire to impress upon others their status as a victor of the Second World War, and as that of a great power still, appears somewhat pathetic in retrospect, and while it was certainly doomed, the depressing failures in former colonies and the ongoing drain on resources which Algeria represented were symptoms of a French Republic struggling desperately with its identity and its position in Europe's future. Into this difficult equation, great irritation and concern accompanied an American hesitation to commit more resources to European defence or to replace American soldiers with tactical nuclear weapons. Deeply concerned with their own spheres of influence in the Middle East and Africa and Asia, both Britain and France adopted the new American approach to tactical nukes and proposed plans to reduce their armed commitment in Europe put tactical nukes there instead, and use these soldiers that they had left over to preserve their positions in colonial spheres. Great American opposition emerged against this plan, and among both NATO and the Western European Union, objections were raised at the prospect of having to spend such enormous amounts on defence. The Americans were at this point still debating the different ways to defend Western Europe during the emerging Cold War, and many still seemed to believe that a withdrawal from Europe would in the end be possible if nukes were used as a deterring force in their place. But Washington didn't want the Europeans to follow this strategy, because it was believed that Paris, London and Bonn, etc., should contribute their armed forces to the defence of the region as an obligation, since it was their land after all. Another concern in the Eisenhower administration, and one which rubbed John Foster Dulles the wrong way, was that Britain and France above all would reassert their dominance over their colonies once they withdrew all these soldiers, which had formerly been used for European defence. Decolonization was one of the tenets of American strategy going forward, in addition to free trade and European integration. The time for acting like empires, Washington insisted, was over. It is worth considering that these tensions between European and American interpretations of the world order in the mid-1950s may have led Eden and his French counterparts to act decisively and aggressively in Egypt. It was certainly assumed that in the case of Egypt, Washington was wholly ignorant of the Anglo-French concerns and interests, and that they did not understand what Suez meant for the security, trade, or resource interests of Paris and London. On the other side of things, we should note the emergence of an Anglo-French Entente Cordiale in spring 1956, and the fact that this was no accident. It is often commented that Egypt brought Anthony Eden and Guy Mollet's governments together, and to an extent this is true, but we would be wise to remember the geopolitical context into which this rapprochement took place, and it was a rapprochement. For many years, a great deal of ink had been spent in Paris about the dangers of an Anglo-American nuclear-capable bloc within NATO. To counteract the potential of this partnership, which already seemed solid in the late 1940s, France was forced to move closer to its former German enemy in a bid to cement a strong Franco-German core in Europe's makeup. This, incidentally, was what Washington wanted to see, but to the French, a German agreement was only Plan B. What they wanted far more was a solid British agreement, at least in the opinion of the historian Ralph Dytel. He wrote, "French hopes lay on the development of the Entente Cordiale. France hoped that Britain would discard the special relationship status with America, retake its place among the European powers, share its nuclear know-how with France, and opt for the common construction of Europe. The Mollet government now started to woo the Europeanists in London with a Franco-British vision of Europe. The spectre of Eurafrica emerged, a European entity with a prosperity sphere, comprising the dependencies of Africa." In the name of this outdated and delusional concept of Eurafrica, did the British and French intervene to reassert their position in Egypt? Suez was critical to this plan, as was a docile Egypt devoid of the kind of Arab nationalism which Nasser continued to spout. The French determination to turn back the clock was accompanied by a similar sense of siege mentality in Britain, where Nasser seemed poised to ruin British fortunes and reputations in his quest for independence. Knowing what we know about the events leading up to this point, it seems reductionist and simplistic to chalk the British collusion down to one specific cause. All factors, from Eden's illness and medication, to Britain's European efforts, to genuine hatred of Nasser, to a need to be seen as a primary power capable of independent action, must all be considered, in addition to many other factors like the anticipated benefit which a docile Egypt would accrue to British strategy in the Middle East, and the potential for resolving the Israeli question this would generate. There can be little doubt that Eden despised everything which Nasser stood for, and all that he stood against. This was the first time that an independent Arab leader of such calibre had emerged in such a sensitive region. Eden could never countenance, would never countenance, such a profound change in the status quo. It was against his nature as a proud Briton of the old imperial school, as much as it was against his political inclinations as a Tory statesman. When attempting to understand why Eden took such a grave and Machiavellian step towards collusion and conspiracy with France and Israel, we can only begin to reach the answer if we consider all the variables and pressures which Eden was under. Don't forget, As the successor of Winston Churchill, Eden had underperformed since assuming office in spring 1955. He was certainly feeling the pressure to prove himself, and to prove as well to his old mentor in Churchill, that he was as capable of standing up to tyrants as Winston had been. In fact, this search for validation, and even approval from Winston, could well have played a role in Eden's consistent comparison of Nasser to Adolf Hitler. Historian A.V. Schlaim provides a good summary of all we've learned so far on Eden's character and motives, and Schlaim wrote in 1997 that Anthony Eden bore the ultimate responsibility and received most of the opprobrium for the collusion with France and Israel. Eden was desperate for a pretext to go to war in order to get rid of Nasser, and the alliance with Israel was the price he reluctantly paid to procure such a pretext. The elaborate plot embodied in the protocol was so transparent that it is still difficult to understand how Eden could have believed that it would not be seen as such. What is clear is that having got embroiled in the war plot, Eden became desperate to hide the traces. His attempt to round up and destroy all the copies of the Protocol of Sèvres has to be seen in this light. He wanted to expunge the war plot, in which Britain had been a reluctant but a full and formal participant, from the historical record. What he embarked on was a massive attempt to deceive. This attempt ended in miserable failure, like all the expedients that Eden had resorted to in his vendetta against the Egyptian leader, whom he perceived, for no good reason, as another Hitler. Try as Eden might, he could not roll back the clock, and he could not equate his underhanded plot with the heroic resistance to the Nazis 15 years before. Britain would stand, not quite alone, but certainly out on an unsteady moral limb. Exactly how unsteady would be demonstrated in near time, but first, a timetable had to be adhered to. Christopher Hitchens wrote that the actual execution of the invasion was a bloody farce from beginning to end. Without consulting or informing the United States or the United Nations or NATO or the Commonwealth, the three colluding powers put the Sèvres plan into operation. On October 29th, Israeli pilots flew four ancient Mustangs at hedge-hopping height across the Sinai, their wings and propellers slicing through Egypt's miserably few telephone lines. With this accomplished, the 202nd paratroop crossed the Egyptian border at Kuntilla under the command of Sharon. Almost simultaneously, Lieutenant Colonel Eitan's men were dropping by parachute near the Mitla Pass, 70 miles inside Egypt. French aircraft flying from British bases in Cyprus began dropping supplies to them on the same day. The fix was in, and the plan concocted a few days before was determinedly underway. There was no backing out for Eden now. He would have to follow the Sèvres Protocol to the letter, all the while denying that such protocol even existed. It was a recipe for abject disaster, humiliation, and further crisis, but fortunately for us, it makes for absolutely fascinating listening. Next time we'll take this story back up as the bullets begin to fly and the world looked on, bewildered and uneasy at the sudden explosion of conflict. The same day that Israeli paratroopers were launched into battle, French airmen moved to supply them and the diplomatic shield was prepared against all of this, the citizens of Budapest were allowing the seemingly impossible to sink in. The Red Army had been beaten and their country was now free. Within a week, both the carefully laid plans of the three allies and the dreams of the Hungarians would be shattered as 1956 rumbled relentlessly onwards. Until next time then, my lovely patrons and history friends, this has been 1956, episode 2.13. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this show, guys, and I'll be seeing you all soon. Surrender to mine. Lay down your arms and surrender.